Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. In the second of two June previews interview episodes, I talk to Mark Roslin, who's the writer of Broken Pieces from Aspen Comics, kind of a modern take on the Frankenstein myth. And next, Damian Smith from the Cryptographic podcast joins me to talk to Buzz Hassan and Ken Hazer, the creators and writers and artists of The Living Corpse that has previously been out from Zenoscope and is now coming out in a new series, The Living Corpse Exhumed from Dynamite Entertainment. And then I talked to Mark Ellis, who is the writer and license holder on The Justice Machine, classic indie team from the 80s that is being revived at Moonstone Comics. Okay, I've now got Mark Roslin with me, who is the writer for the new series from Aspen Comics called Broken Pieces. Thanks for joining me, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we have the zero issue of Broken Pieces coming out in August from Aspen, and that is the precursor to a five-issue miniseries. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Broken Pieces?
Yes, the issue zero is August 3rd. It's like Aspen does these 12-page issue zeros that kind of give you a feel for the story so you can try it out at a lower price point and get the feel of the book. Basically, the book is going to be, it takes place 20 years, give or take, in the future. It's like a dystopian future, but not one that we typically see. It's more of a fake happy kind of future where a big catastrophe happens, a biological bomb goes off in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's destroying the United States, and basically its effects are out of control, and the government needs to do something. The people are worried, lives were lost, and its effects are creeping up the entire eastern seaboard. So this company that is a government contracted company, Trinion, they are supposed to find some sort of cure, some sort of antidote to this biological bomb that went off. So they hire this two scientists, this couple. They're married and they're working in regeneration, and they make an offer to her, to the main girl, Gabriella Adams, and her husband, Richard Adams, and they say, look, like, you're doing regeneration. All these other scientists are doing all these other things, these other companies. We want you because we think regeneration, we can help, you know, fix your cells and everything. So they ask them to create this cure, and they set up this lab, and they start working. And basically these two scientists create this Frankenstein-like monster, piece together parts of different tissues, like repaired lungs and everything, because they have to see if everything works together and if it's something that you could give, you know, a human being and its effects and how long the regeneration process works. And basically they create this monster, and he kind of causes some havoc, but without giving away too much of the story, it's a Frankenstein-like dystopian story. It's going to be pretty crazy.
Now, your artist on this is Micah Kaneshiro. Tell us a little bit about your process for designing the look of the world 20 years in the future and this monster and, you know, all the kind of stuff that goes into the series with Micah.
Yes. Micah, we found him at San Diego Comic-Con. He's he was a concept artist, and he had these crazy designs, and something we weren't really initially thinking for the book. We were initially kind of thinking for like a more grittier take, and he's very clean, and we figured this would actually give the book something original and unexpected look, because going gritty and everything, that's what people kind of expect out of Aspen. And this way, when we were thinking, you know, this is a dystopian kind of story, to give it this clean, more happier look actually gives it a different vibe than what we would be used to. So we approached him and asked if he would be interested. He wasn't familiar with doing comic book artwork, like storytelling. He was more of a like layout artist, doing like movie and game design stuff. So we've been working with him about, you know, adjusting to the comic book page storytelling. And he started out with just a bunch of character designs. We talked back and forth about what we thought the monster and the story should look like, because we didn't want it to be like Frankenstein. We didn't want it to be the Hulk. We didn't want it to be certain things, but we did kind of want to capture a monster that still could be relatable. And that's what he was good at. He threw out, you know, 20 different designs for different characters and different shots. For the main scientists in the story, the two doctors, Richard and Gabriella, we had talked about it, and we talked about different movie stars that we kind of liked and thought that would fit these characters. And one star we kind of decided on was Hugh Jackman for the main guy. So he had done some different takes about Hugh Jackman-ish looking characters. And we just, you know, went from there. He's been great to work with, very, very good and at just giving you multiple options, and he takes in everything you tell him, and very easy to work with. He's fantastic. We'll be showing more of his art soon online, so there'll be some previews of the artwork going up pretty soon here.
So since he's been doing concept art and that, have you been working more full script with him and kind of helping him with his panel-to-panel storytelling as this book goes on?
Yeah, I gave him the complete plot and then a full script and try to get him as involved in the story as much as possible, because also the way the story is going to be told, it's called Broken Pieces. We're kind of telling the story a little bit in a fragmented sense, not just a traditional linear story. So he really needed to know what was going to happen in issue 2, 3, because that reflects what's in 0 and 1. So I had to make sure he wasn't confused at all, and I basically gave him the entire story all together at one time, and then went full in depth with the scripts for issue 0 and 1. He's well into issue 1 right now, and he knows, or he's doing everything from the layouts to the pencils, and he's coloring it as well. Like, he's a full package kind of guy. And we just went over everything, and he lives San Diego, which is about 2 hours from here, and we would make him drive up to the studio and go over anything that wasn't quite hitting the mark in terms of capturing the story pieces that we really wanted to emphasize. But again, he's been great to work with. He really knows what he's doing, but we just needed to tweak a little things to make it more fit the comic book page and not just too much of a storybook, I guess.
Yeah. Well, 2 hours on a really good day.
Yeah, right.
I live down in South Orange County, and I it's taking me 2 hours sometimes to get up into L.A. where you guys are.
Yeah.
So here's a question I've got for you, though, and I don't want to spoiler, obviously, but it's always interesting to me when you do kind of the nonlinear storytelling. What is the device? What's the storytelling device, whether it's in captions or in the art or something, that's going to help the reader understand the scene transitions and that you're kind of jumping around in a nonlinear fashion?
Yeah, we're going to have, there's going to be major clear to see captions explaining this is before and this is now. And then on top of that, there's also going to be some flashback scenes. So there's basically three timelines going on. But the flashback scenes will be colored differently, so those will be easy to pick out. and then you'll just have to follow the before and now, and those will be clearly illustrated through the caption style and saying, you know, this is now and this is before. We went through multiple different ways of trying to figure that out so it was clear, but I think, you know, we figured out a way that will work, and I think it's smart and it's going to be well presented, but, you know, there'll still be some people that might find themselves a little confused. Hopefully, you know, once you read it together, the entire first zero and one, you'll really catch on, and then number two, you'll look back and go, oh, I kind of want to reread issue one now after seeing what just happened in issue two. And that was my goal, was to do something a little unconventional, you know, take the rules and try and break them a little bit without losing the reader and making things confusing.
Okay, cool. So let's talk a little bit about... I'm looking at the cover of issue number one, and I see we've got one of those little... Or actually, issue number zero, sorry. We've got one of those little square jobs that you, like, can scan with your phone to...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
With the, it's kind of like a barcode, but I don't know what you call those now that,
yeah,
that you
QR
shoot
codes
with your smartphone.
Yeah, they're QR codes. That's the image from issue zero, but that's not the official cover to zero. It won't have that barcode. Those are QR codes that you can scan with your phone, and they'll take you. That one will take you to the Facebook page, where we'll be showing, you know, clips of the artwork and upcoming things to see, and more insight into the book, and hopefully. Some viral things will happen there shortly that'll just, you know, help accentuate the book and get people into the story. That was something new that I wanted to try, just for people to get a little extra out of their book and get some more information than just, here's a book, read it. It's more of a, oh, I see where they're going with things. And that's kind of what we're going to use the Facebook page to do, give, you know, some panels, some character descriptions, show off, you know, artwork, concept stuff, and also reveal some more about the story. Since it is kind of broken up, hopefully you'll get a little more, little hints here and there about what's going to happen.
Okay, very good. So, now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I mean, I know you've been an editor at Aspen. I think you worked on Delek.
No, actually, no. That's Vince Hernandez. I work in the, I'm the graphic designer and production guy. So I've been with the company basically since started in 2003. I moved out from the East Coast out here to work at Aspen because I heard they were starting the company up. They had just put out a couple of issues and I joined up, and I was doing comic book lettering in the very beginning. And then I started taking on more and more, where now I'm doing, like, the advertising, the design, the book layout, everything that involves the book-making process, as well as I'm digitally inking some of the books as well, which I've done. Soulfire over Michael Turner and a Superman Batman run was just adjusting his pencils because it went straight from pencils to color. And now I'm doing Lady Mechanica with Joe Benitez, which is also his pencils to colors. And I've done some things with Marvel Ultimate Comics X over Art Adams. And I just recently Astonishing Spider-Man and Wolverine with Adam Kubert was doing some digital inks over those.
Okay, cool. But this is your first writing on Broken Pieces.
Yeah, so. I was given the opportunity by when Mike passed away, the company was left to Frank Mastromaro and Peter Sagerwald, and when Mike passed, like, he had more ideas that he wanted to do, but he was also pushing all of us working there to develop our creative ideas. And so Frank and Peter were like, you know what, Mike wanted us to create and push forward, and they were giving us an opportunity to create our own characters and worlds and everything, as long as we were able to still continue our jobs and do everything. There was no timetable, so I easily jumped on it and spent the past 2 years developing this story. And it's a story I've had for over 6 years in my head, and just had to find the time to actually develop it. And Vince Hernandez, the editor-in-chief, went on to do Kara's Magic, which was his big idea. And Frank and Peter both have two ideas that they would like to do as well. Those are on the horizon. So this is something that didn't just pop up. It's something I've been working on for a long time, and it was just a matter of when I'm ready to do it, then we'll do it. And finally, this August is when issue zero comes out. So it's actually been a long time coming, and although I'm not a comic book writer, I have written things in the past, just not comic book related, and this is like a big kind of foray jumping into. I did a lot of research, spent my time making sure this is as perfect as it could be, and hopefully everyone will like it, and hopefully I can do some more.
Very good. So your zero issue's out in August, on August 3rd. Your number one issue will be out as
first week of September.
One of the 53 number ones that are coming out in September.
Yeah.
This will be the non-superhero one.
he won't be wearing tights. So if you're looking for something different, this is the one you want to get.
Very good. Well, I think everyone should check out the Facebook page and take a look at this and see some of the concept art that's out there. And I think the zero issues are a good way to kind of get into it and see how the story is going to be. Now, that leads me to one more question. How did you structure that 12 pages that you have to really try to hook people in? Because, you know, people are going to buy this zero issue, and you've got 12 pages of story in there that you really have to sell this to make somebody want to come back for the number one. How did you take on that challenge?
Yeah, the zero went through a couple revisions and a couple different takes, but I wanted to show different pieces of the story. I wanted to show the scientists, I wanted to show the monster, and I wanted to show the antagonist in the story. So there's a little bit of each in the issue zero, so you get a better sense of these characters, as well as show off Micah Kaneshiro's art and see what he can do, but give the readers a sense of the place, the time this takes place in, the setting, and really kind of hint towards the major points of the story. But also I had to shave off all the the things that might, you know, take away from the story. But those will show up in issue one and two and then continue on. But it definitely is tough to fit what you want in 12 pages. I think we did a good job. Me and the editors talked about what should be and not be. And I think issue zero is a very solid preview issue. You should definitely check it out August 3rd. There's more information on brokenpiecescomic.com, where you can read a little bit more about the book, as well I'll be showing off artwork there and the Facebook page. So if you're curious after issue zero, then you can check out those sites and learn a little bit more.
Well, thank you for taking time with me, and I'll be looking forward to Broken Pieces number zero coming August 3rd.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob.
We're talking with Ken Hazer and Buzz Hassan, the creators of The Living Corpse, relaunching from Dynamite Entertainment. And joining me for this interview is Damian Smith, better known as Lord Shaper from the Cryptographic Podcast. Thanks for joining me, everyone.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Good to be one of these.
Buzz and Ken, let's start out with, since The Living Corpse is a relaunch, and you originally put out, I believe, 6 issues and a hack slash special, maybe something else I'm forgetting from Zenoscope. Let's let the listeners who haven't seen the series before give them kind of the skinny on what the series is about and some of the main characters and the world.
Okay. This is Ken. Let me see. We got the main character is the Living Corpse, of course, and he is a zombie, but he's also a good guy, as good as a zombie can get. And he came back and he met a fallen angel named Astaroth, who helps him along his way, but it's basically his job to fight off bad guys, monsters that creep into the world of the living.
Meanwhile, he was dealing with being a zombie at the same time, and he had like a little bit of his conscience left from who he was before, but you know, his memories are still real fuzzy. So as he like goes on and you know, what existence he's got, he's partnered almost with like a fallen angel. It's talking about Astaroth.
And he's still like your basic zombie, where he still has to eat brains, and he still lives in a graveyard, and all that good kind of stuff that the horror fans like.
And then, like, you know, one of the things that, like, from doing, I guess, the, you know, like a zombie hero book amongst the zombie genre of different zombie comics, we were talking about how we wanted to do it from the perspective of a zombie. And that's why he's a central character. Rather than just, like, a survival, shoot-em-up, you know, type Walking Dead book.
Right, but he does fight against supernatural threats, so he went against a Sasquatch and vampires and werewolves, and you know he's actually protecting people from these other supernatural threats.
Yeah, it's his job to like keep the balance between the world of the living and you know the nightmare world full of vampires and werewolves and all kinds of good stuff like that. Frankenstein, we had Wendigo,
and like a voodoo queen priestess. Which was a fun story because we mixed up where, you know, the fans that pick up the trade or have the original issues know from the story that he, of course, got taken under control from her voodoo powers, which was interesting, kind of switched them up. And, you know, it's what we're doing in the new series, too, is, you know, taking the character in places that are further into their mind on this.
And this has been a long time coming, too. Like, this is continuing on from the original series that came from Zenoscope, isn't it?
Yeah. The issue number one that's coming out in August was actually going to be issue 7, but since we switched over, you know, we beefed it up, made it nice, and made it a good solid first issue. And we were lucky enough when we left the Zenoscope, it was right in between storylines. So, yeah. And also we got the Omnibus, which reprints everything that Zenoscope put out, which was a half issue, a zero issue, issue 1 to 6, and the annual attack slash. That's all going to be one big, huge trade. And that'll be coming out when the first issue comes out in August.
Cool. So that should be in the solicits.
It's on page 273. So they're both on the same page, which is good.
Great.
Yeah.
So
right
go to
now,
page 273 and have a look. Now, did you add into issue 7 anything to kind of bring readers up to speed on the status quo? Is there something kind of like on the inside of the front cover or a couple of pages in with some exposition?
No, we actually got, was it 1, 2, 3, 4, like 7 pages we added onto it as like a recap of everything. So once you pick up issue 1, there's like a 7-page recap in the beginning and it goes right into the story. So if you don't know it, you don't need to know it. So we jump right back
either way.
Excellent. Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing Astaroth coming back into it because you have that sort of appearance back in, I think it was the half issue first up, and sort of then you've got hints throughout, and I'm wondering what he's actually up to. So it's been a while,
and
I'm definitely looking forward to
Astaroth a lot in the first one, but we're going to get into him a lot more in the next one.
Now, yeah, he's actually a pretty bold character in the film, too.
So the film is going ahead now?
You've let that cat out of the bag. I didn't know if we were able to talk about that or not. Why don't you talk a little bit about the film?
It's been being worked on since, like, 08. Are you asking about the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. They've been working on it for about 3 years now, and Ken had written a screenplay adaption, and then they had written their own. We kind of went back and forth, but they ended up coming up with a place they're telling a story that's almost like a prologue of where we started with issue one, or actually issue zero. It's between zero issue and issue one from the last series. And in there, the corpse, I don't want to give it away, but it definitely hits a full-on monster realm. There's like tons of new characters he designed, and then there's Astaroth from the original series, which really gets into like his relationship with the corpse a little bit, and then you start to see some familiar characters from the regular series. But I'm not sure what the running time on the movie is. I don't know if Ken knows. I think it's like an hour, 45 minutes or something like that.
Last time I looked, it was like an hour and a half.
Okay.
That's pretty solid. But it's actually kind of cool because what we did was we put out the zero issue was his origin issue where he comes back and you see what happens when he first comes back, and then with issue one it kind of jumps ahead 25 years and he's been doing it for a while, and the movie guys were like, we really don't want to step on anybody's toes, so what do you say about we do something from the time between the zero issue and the half issue, so you get to see him coming into his own until he's like the kick-ass zombie that we see in issue one, just beating up werewolves and whatnot. So it's cool. It's the stuff we were like, we'll just skip over it because we didn't really want to get into it. But they really took the idea of, building him up, the whole thing with his son and with meeting Astaroth and finding out, all the stuff in the underworld and all that good stuff. And it's really good. I'm pretty happy with it. Like, me and Buzz actually saw, it was like 6 months ago, we saw like a rough cut.
Yeah, it was like a whole movie with half rendering.
Yeah, and very happy with it. Very happy with it. I think everybody's going to dig it.
So when's it scheduled to be finished?
I think October. I know they're taking it around to like film festivals coming up through soon, and with it almost being done, it's supposed to be finished in like mid-summer, which we're almost there. And then the promotion training starts. And we really weren't allowed to say when it was coming out. We had to wait to see what was in the new Fangoria article, but it looks like they're talking about in October, at least hoping to have it come out by then, which is good because it's like right around the comic will be like already coming out.
Very good. Now, back to the comic really quick. A question that I have that I found interesting also about something you guys came up with was that the living corpse can kind of travel from point to point, from graveyard to graveyard through kind of this supernatural realm. Why don't you talk a little bit about where that idea came from and how that works?
Yeah, that idea, it came from us thinking like, he's got to go like to different places. Like, he's got to go to like different countries, different places, and how does like a zombie travel? So we were just like, well, how's he going to get around? And, and honestly, we were like, it's cool if we have him going into a graveyard and coming out of a graveyard, then like every time he travels, we can like have a cool shot of him coming out of the grave again, and just keep going and doing that kind of thing. But
yeah, like almost like a rebirth. Every time he, he's gets a link on monsters or dwellings and stuff like that, he's able to sort of portal himself in and out of graveyards, which, is where the zombie's from. So really, it picks up. With issue three in the original series, we went, into like the native lands and were able to take him into that. And then he switches up to a little, into the Iceland and stuff where the Frankenstein was in issues five and six. So we wanted to be able to tell stories for a while, and we thought that every walk of culture has to have some kind of like death culture of it of its own. So he would be there.
Okay, and so is it still the same team? I know that both of you were doing the art and the story for it, but you still have the same inker on there? I think it was Chris was the inker, the color on there. So it's still the same team, what you originally had?
Well, we actually got Chris is coming in to do the coloring for the new stuff, but for the original stuff, I did all the coloring, and Chris helped out with the coloring on the annual.
It's been a while since I've looked at them.
Yeah. But everything else is just done by me and Buzz.
And that's Ken talking. You're the one who did the coloring.
Yeah.
Why don't you guys talk a little bit about designing the character, you know, both the living corpse as well as some of the other main characters in the series, and also talk a little bit about the process, you know, how you guys work together, and, you know, you're doing it some practical and then in digital. How are you kind of bouncing the pages back and forth between each other, you know, writing the stories, roughing them out, you know, et cetera?
We, usually we, you know, well, go ahead, Ken.
No, I was just saying, where should we start?
Nice, simple question.
There's a lot of different ways.
What's the first thing you
said? I think it's just, you know, I think just from hanging out, you know what I mean, and being fans of horror, fans of comics, fans of superhero stuff, we just really generate, like, what we would like to see and what would be fun to draw, and then sort of just start plotting it out, like, you know, the overall process that we see, like, the corpse and what he's going to go do, and then depending on the issue that we're working on and, like, what characters are involved, Ken will break down the whole story into the layouts and then kind of pass the art off to me to pencil and tighten up, and then lately this has been, like, the process that we've been doing where Ken will finish the inks, add details, put it in the solid black so that the artwork works as, like, a black and white, and then we'll do all the coloring in there.
Exactly. And as for the design of the living corpse, that actually took us a while. I remember me and Buzz just chilling out and just drawing zombies nonstop. You look at a zombie and, you know, they can be very, very generic looking. So we wanted to do something that's a little different. And we also wanted to, like, homage a lot of stuff. Like, you notice he's got, like, the underbite with the jaw hanging out from, like, the evil Ash from Army of Darkness. Because, you know, that's a big influence on us. But, and he's got, like, the lazy eye, like the old Boris Karloff Frankenstein. Like, give him the big popped out eye just to really pop him out. And just from that, it was a lot of drawing back and forth. And you can probably see, like, in the comic, like, he evolves a bit and he gets, you know, as we get more comfortable drawing him, like, now we could just do it with our eyes closed.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing about, you know, independent comics is, you know, you can see, like, the growth of artists through it as they, you know, do their book. And, you know, but the whole time there, like, we have a sense of humor ourselves, so we wanted him to have a sense of humor as well for being bitter, for having to stick around as a zombie. So a lot of times when, you know, we're coming up with, like, what he might say or, you know, what he's going to do or how he would react, it's a little bit of slapstick in there to make him, like, an enjoyable character for us as well. And, you know, we're big fans of, like, the Evil Dead series, so, you know, just that humor, that horror, that character comes through and, you know, almost, you know, creating his own little universe.
And let's see, who else we got? Like, Astaroth's, like, the oldest character we got. He was actually in a series that we did called The Eyes of Asia years ago.
Well, I still haven't been able to find that one.
Oh, yeah, that came out through Digital Legends. It was a little hard to find. There wasn't that much coming out, but...
Yeah.
But, yeah, he played a prominent role in that. So you can actually read that and see how the end of his life goes.
That was actually when I first met Ken, he was working on that, and that's what drew me to work with him, was to see his work, all the work he put into Eyes of Asia. So if any listeners out there that's a fan of the corpse and you don't have, I recommend getting it. I think it's a lot on eBay.
Yeah, you can definitely find it for cheap on eBay.
Well, that's the thing with cheap comics on eBay is you'll pay, like, a lot more in shipping than the actual comic.
You learn who to buy through that way. I know I have.
That's got to stink for Australia, right?
Well, to be honest, with the dollar as it is these days, the comics have came down quite a lot, so I'm not paying as much as what I was. So I'm not paying, like, $6 an issue or something like that anymore. It has dropped a bit, but I still get stuff from DCBS as well, so I go for the ultra-cheap stuff through them and then get my local shop. And also, I'm supporting both, but I'm also making sure that just the stuff that, like, you know, 50, 75% off, I'll get it from DCBS because the shipping from them is fairly negligible. You know, $50 worth of comics from them is, you know, works out at about, well, maybe $75 worth here or $100 worth here if I bought it straight in the shop without discount. So,
yeah, definitely, you know, the shipping cost when you buy online, you know, I can't imagine somebody buying online if they're only getting like 5 comic books a month or something. I mean, the shipping cost would wash away any discount. But if you get a decent number of books, you know, the shipping cost becomes relatively reasonable compared to the discount you're getting. And that's, you know, any of the online places that you go to that have good discounts.
Right.
Now, what about digital? Do you know anything about, it's big in the news right now because the DC relaunch that was lighting up the internet recently and their digital plans. Do you know what Dynamite has got going on digital comics?
I know they definitely do have a plan, but I don't think I'm allowed to talk about it yet because they haven't announced it yet. But they won't even tell me about it. But supposedly, like, I asked Nick over there, and I'm like, what about digital? He's like, oh, we got something good planned. So I guess we'll all just wait and see. But it is coming.
I have seen recently a couple. I was surprised to see because I didn't know they had anything online. But I think it's like Comixology, like an app I downloaded on my iPhone that you can buy like comics for 99 cents. And I usually just get the free ones. But I think I've seen Red Sonja on there before, so I'm sure they got something like that I was talking about. But this thing is just a matter of how you release it, you know, because it's so accessible that, you know, if you put all of it out there, you'll really kind of like have all your books out there already, and then, you know, kind of like the kind of new piece of the industry that I think you have to approach slowly, but when you do well.
Right.
Me, I'm old school. I can't stand digital comics. I
actually don't like them either.
Need the paper.
You know,
I need to hold the book.
I'm kind of the same way, but, you know, I have no personal interest in buying digital comics for myself, but I'm very fascinated by the concept of digital comics because I think that's going to be the way that we get an infusion of new people in the market because, you know, it's really difficult to get people to go and hunt down and go to a comic shop, you know?
Yeah, when you get it,
true.
And look at it on your phone.
And especially on indie books. Sorry, Damian, just really quick is that I find that, you know, you go to a shop, and that's why we're trying to do the interview when the book's in previews, because if people don't go and ask their shop now, the chances of it actually being in the shop when the book comes out in a couple of months are negligible, you know, because the store might buy for people on the pull list and then another one or two copies for the rack. Well, a couple people go in, buy that book, and now all of a sudden, even if you go to the comic shop, you're not going to find that. Whereas on digital, someone who wants it, you know, click, and there you have it.
Yeah, especially with, like, issue number 2 and 3, because, like, issue 2 and 3 get solicited even before issue 1's, like, in the stores. So, you know, everybody, they'll do all right with issue 1, but then they'll cut the orders in half for issue 2, and then no one finds it.
I think if you remember when I got, I think, what was the first, was it the 0 issue or the half issue came out first?
I think it was half issue.
The half issue. Because when I think I got a copy of that from you guys, but I actually went to the shop, paid for it, and told them to put it back on the shelf. So they weren't going to lose that money, and they've got another one there that they can show to someone else or use it as a demo copy or whatever they want, just so people can look through it and read it.
Dude, appreciate it. That's real cool. And they're still making some money.
First time I've heard anybody doing that.
Yeah. But I thought that was an easier way because I had it on order anyway. You guys sent me a copy, so it was like, okay, I'll just buy it anyway and tell them to keep it. I think they ended up leaving it there for a week and then took it home themselves and liked it and started buying it themselves.
Hey, it's with the little comics. We've got to do, you know, one person at a time.
But,
especially, you know, through conventions and stuff. That's where you meet, you know, other retailers. You try to get the book supported out there.
But one thing I noticed, actually, with digital comics, just going back onto that, one thing that I've read a couple, I didn't get many. Like, I've read the web comic style, and I've read Freak Angels every week, and there's the new Crossed one coming out after that finishes in about 10 issues. But you've got One thing that I think Ben Templesmith did with IDW was he actually had a soundtrack that went along with Wormwood. So when you hit a certain panel, this is on the PSP, when you actually hit a certain panel, he actually was telling you about what was going on at that point. So I think that's the way that I'd like it to go, you know, so you get a bit of background on what they're talking. Sort of like, it was really odd, like you're sitting there looking through it and then suddenly you have Ben talking to you. But yeah, pretty good. That's the way I can see it actually getting people to double dip.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that too, but getting people to double dip in the other direction, or, you know, I would like to see people still buying physical comics, and that's where I'd like to see kind of like the DVD extras, you know, it's like you add a few pages into the physical comic, put the, you know, sketchbook type material, put some stuff about, you know, behind the scenes and other kind of things like that, whereas on the digital comic, you pretty much have the story.
Yeah, kind of like if you don't, you watch a movie on Netflix and you really like it, you want to see some extra stuff, you go buy the DVD.
Are you going to be doing the letter columns again, like you did in the original one, the original series?
Not too sure. Did you, like them?
Oh, I liked them. And the fact that they actually came from the forums as well, so you actually took questions out of the forums and replied to them and stuff like that was actually always good too. So it was odd seeing, you know, quote, I didn't know I'd sent that in.
But, I'm a big fan of letter columns. It's really good to communicate with people that you really don't get to. But, yeah, I'd definitely love to. So not for first issue, but maybe for the rest of them.
Very good. So, let's see, what else do we want to say about the actual comic? I do want to remind people, go to your shop now if you're interested in this book. Absolutely tell them that you're interested in the book and that you want to buy it in August, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, it's
because
it's
in previews now. And you want them to order that book, because if they don't order it for you, it's not going to be sitting in the shop for you in August.
Exactly. Then we're going to have to go get real jobs.
And you'll want to read it. You've got the movie coming out for it. There's a lot more than just, you know, the start of the six issues here and a trade coming out. The movie was coming first, if I remember correctly, and that the actual movie deal is what got you the comic deal, which is the back way of going around things. But I'm glad that it came out, because, you know, I would have never been introduced to you through Brian. And I know I've been talking on and off with you guys for years now. So.
Yeah, you fucked my ass.
Yeah, which it's really cool that people have waited this long, because it's been, what, like 2.5, 3 years since the annual came out?
Great.
It seems like people were waiting for it. You know, in this industry, if you don't put anything out for a while, you just get forgotten. But we still do all the conventions, and like it got to the point where, you know, all the people that are going to buy it already bought it, and like next year to come back, they're like, what do you got new? I loved it, blah, blah. And I'm like, nothing new yet. So it was like more and more people, you know, looking for new stuff. So appreciate everybody waiting this long. We haven't stopped since we left. We've been working nonstop on it. So it's we just finished up the artwork for issue 5, and we're working on issue 6 right now. So it'll be coming out monthly too.
I know, I've seen some artwork for issue 3. So
issue 3.
That's the one I'm waiting for.
Yeah.
And you watch, there's going to be a bidding war on one of the pages or two of the pages there.
Oh, that's the one with you and Brian, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, they get a nice little cameo. They actually get a good cameo in that.
Yeah, I think they're on like 3 pages.
Wow, cool.
I only know of 2 of them, and I know that me and Brian have spoken outside. It was sort of like, okay, which one do you want? And we both wanted the same.
We're like, we should put those guys on every page, so they have to buy them all.
It's just that main one that had the desk with the sitting on it facing frontward, and it's like everybody wants that page.
Yeah,
I shouldn't complain. I've got the actual Astaroth perched on, you know, the full page Astaroth splash from the half issue, the very last page.
Oh yeah, the last page of that, right?
I've got that one.
That's a good one.
Whereas I have the first page with Lilith on it.
Do you really?
Yeah, that's right. You were asking me about some of the changes that you had noticed from the comic to the page.
That's right. You made a couple of little tweaks to the art between the art that I have and the published one. But let me also point out to the listeners, you know, this is a Damien pestered me for like a year and a half to try this book out. And I was like, you know. And then I finally got a couple of issues and I read them and I loved them. And once that was in, then I was like buying all the rest of the issues. And, you know, then I burned through, you know, all the issues that there were. And it's like, oh, there's no more. And now it's finally coming back. But, you know, what I like about it is, you know, because I've always liked zombie movies. But this is, you know, I'm reading like the Avatar, you know, Night of the Living Dead stuff and, you know, some of the other books. But it's this one's got that, like you were saying, it's that a little bit of a twist on the zombie one because it turns it around. And he's not like this mindless, you know, walking around kind of zombie. He's actually, he's got a personality. He's got a mission. He's doing stuff. And, you know, that's what really, you know, that personality, I think that's what makes him, you know, the living corpse as opposed to a zombie.
Right.
Yeah, we really felt like we created a, you know, a character that we thought was cool, you know, like a different take. And as popular as some of the other zombie books were, maybe over our first series, like we wanted to stick with it because then you had some staying power and the potential for a lot of stories.
Right.
And,
you know,
and like you said, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, a lot of zombie books are kind of like that one note kind of book. I mean, you got the zombies and most of them end up being, you know, they're concentrating on that survival thing. You know, you got the zombie plague and people are trying not to get bit by zombies and, you know, and lots of other things happen, but that's the main impetus to those kinds of stories. Whereas this one, you can do lots more stuff. You bring in all these other types of monsters. So people who just like seeing lots of different kinds of monsters. I mean, heck, you had the Wendigo and the Shaman and, you know, all these different kind of Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein and all these different things that come into it. Just someone who loves monsters in general will love this book.
Thanks, man. It's us trying to do different stuff, too. Like you were saying before, it's like The Walking Dead, awesome book, but it's like total 180 from that. It's like, you know, we started out, we're like, yeah, let's do a zombie book, but, you know, we didn't want to do the same Romero thing that's been done a million times and so well. So we're like, we'll make him the good guy. And we're like, we're looking at zombie comics, and all the zombie comics were like scratchy, realistic, dark artwork. So we're like, let's make ours look like a Saturday morning cartoon and make it kind of funny. So it's just trying to do something different and trying to stick out at the same time.
Like the artwork's a lot like your creepy and eerie style artwork, but if I would want to say Scooby Doo was done in that style. So you've got the actual monsters that are, you know, they have that cartoonish look to it or that caricaturish look to it, but it's, you know, it adds to the book. It doesn't take away from it at all. So
it's part of the charm of the book. It does make it stand out. You know, and not having that hyper-realistic, you know, gore kind of feel to it does give the book a definite ability to stand out from the other kinds of books.
Well, it shows you don't need that to have a horror book as well, which is one thing that a lot of books, they think the more gore there is, the better it's going to be, and it's not that.
And you can do, and with having like a zombie as a main character, you can do like so many stuff. Like we just, me and Buzz just sat down and we're like, do this, we'll do that. We had a list of characters we wanted to do, and, you know, Nosferatu and the Wendigo. And it just comes down to like, if you look at like the, just doing something different. Like you see, the Wendigo legend is if you eat your flesh in the north, you turn into the Wendigo. So we're like, well, what would happen if, you know, the corpse ate somebody's brain up there? What would happen to him? And that's where, you know, that came from. Or if like a voodoo queen came after him, what would he be? Would he be able to fight her, or would she just take control of him? So it's just playing around with things that have been around for a long time and just, you know, putting their own little twist on them.
Yeah, that's like the most important, I think, is the fun involved. You know, when we were doing the Frankenstein storyline, the Modern Prometheus, you know, we were just like excited to do the idea of a super intelligent Frankenstein monster versus the actual, you know, man. This is just something you haven't seen, you know. It's, you know, anything you can do to like put your own spin on it is the way to go.
Well, that's what's going to make it stand out from all the other same books out there. So that's why people have to go and pick this one up.
Right. So I will encourage again, everyone, check it out. Do you have any place online that people can see some samples of some of the existent stories so they can kind of get a visual sample of what they'd be getting into here?
Yeah, you can go to
Corpsecomic.com.
Same thing.
CorpseComic.com.
Very good. And we'll put that URL in the show notes. I will ask everyone once again, get out to your comic shop. Well, let's go look at the website, take a look at what the stuff looks like, and if it appeals to you the way that it did to me, the way that it did to Damien, make sure you go to your comic shop, make sure you ask them to order it, and that way you'll have it in your hands come August. And maybe your shop has some of the back issues from Zenoscope as well. You can always ask. Thanks for joining me, guys. And looking forward to August coming around.
Us too. Can't wait.
Can't wait.
Same with me.
Cool.
I am now talking to Mark Ellis, who is writing the relaunch of the Justice Machine coming out from Moonstone in your June previews on page 296. Thanks for joining me, Mark.
I'm glad to be here, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Now, I read Moonstone back in the day. This series is going to be a continuation, I understand?
Yes, it's a continuation of the series that came out in from Kimiko, starting in 1986, although the original Justice Machine first appeared in 1981 from a short-lived company called Noble Comics. That was the one that had the John Byrne cover, which has become somewhat iconic.
Right. I had both of those series. I had the Noble series and the Kimiko series.
Right. So, you know, that that lasted five issues, the Noble series did, and then it went under, and then it was revived in 1986 from Kimiko with Justice Machine featuring the Elementals miniseries.
Right. And even in between, there was like a one-shot of some sort, as I recall, like an annual or something.
Yeah, it was Texas Comics. They published the Justice Machine Annual Number 1, which featured a crossover with the Thunder Agents. And that was actually the first appearance of the Elementals. They showed up as a backup feature in that. And oddly, that whole Justice Machine Annual Number 1 with the Thunder Agents, Thunder Agents were on the cover, but not the Justice Machine.
So let's talk a little bit about the Justice Machine for people who are not familiar with the team. I always liked it. I like team comics, and you get, you know, a lot of different characters. But let's talk about this particular team and what makes it special.
Well, the Justice Machine are like a super-powered special forces law enforcement agency for a... you know, they were on an alternate Earth called Jor-El, a dystopia, obviously, with the name of Jor-El. It's a combination of George and Orwell. So they were, you know, very much, you know, law and order, by the rules types. And then when their immediate superior betrayed them for his own purposes, they ended up on Earth. And then they sort of had to learn, you know, relearn a lot of things, about, you know, duty and honor and how they're both not necessarily the same thing. And just basically come to terms with the way they had been living for, you know, many years. So the when they in the Noble comic-ish thing, it was a similar plot. And then when it was sort of rebooted with the Elementals, it was a similar thing. They had, the Elementals had come to Jor-El and helped them fight an enemy called Dark Force, who was something of a type of villain of the scope of Darkseid or Thanos. So then in the Justice Machine got their own series from Kamiko. They returned to Earth, and that's where they stayed. They went on in exile. So it was pretty unique as far as it goes. Most Super Team books didn't have that kind of origin. They're all, you know, different types of personalities with different kinds of powers, and a couple of them didn't even have any powers for that matter.
Right, so let's kind of go over the characters. I remember, you know, we had the big guy, you know, Titan.
Right.
Kind of a giant man kind of guy. He can grow really big, and he's strong.
Right. And then there was Blazer, who was sort of like a female Human Torch, only her powers are slightly different than the Human Torch's. At one time, she couldn't control her powers and had to wear a suit to keep, you know, herself from spontaneously combusting. That got changed after a certain point. Then there's Demon, who is like considered the world's fastest man, not like Quicksilver or the Flash. He's just really fast, super reflexes, super acrobat, you know, a highly trained martial artist and recovering drug addict, which is one of the reasons of he was so fast, I guess. It was like some super methamphetamine that he was taking on Jor-El. Then there was Talisman, who was a character who outwardly had no real powers. He just wore like a dark business suit, and he was a guy that if he always had to do some sort of good deed, otherwise karma would, you know, slap him back in the face. So he'd be the kind of guy that if people were attacking him, if he just stood there, like their pants would fall down or some would fall off of a building and hit him in the head. But only if he hadn't done anything bad beforehand, which was always tough because he had real criminal tendencies. Then there was Diviner, who was she had artificially enhanced senses because she was born with no senses, really, blind and deaf and dumb, but she had some sort of implants, bionic implants, which allowed her to not only, you know, have just normal senses but enhanced ones as well. And she was married to Challenger, who's a team leader, who I guess you might say he's sort of like the Captain America type of the group. You know, he was an acrobat and a gymnast and, you know, martial artist and everything. He's kind of the old grizzled war horse. He also was the only guy who carried guns, so. There's a new character. Well, she's not really new. There's another character that's making her reappearance in the new miniseries called Chain, who has the power to... I guess it's basically split molecules with, you know, some form of telekinesis. She can, like, cut through anything, but she has to have a channel. So in this, she has, like, a chainsaw, which she uses to channel her powers. Daryl Banks came up with that power back when we were doing it for Innovation in Millennium.
Cool. Now, if I understand correctly, Mike Gustavich originally created the team, and at some point along the line, was it you that purchased the rights to the Justice Machine? You bought the publishing rights or the outright rights to the team? How did that work?
We bought the outright rights. I did. I had written the book. It had been published at Kamiko for a number of years, and when Kamiko sort of went under, that was, you know, the original owner sold it to another guy. Mike Gustavich then took the book to Innovation. So I wrote it at Innovation. We did like a reboot and a revamp. We wanted a reboot. Let's say revamp. It was still the same series, but we just did some different things with it. And I teamed up with Daryl Banks on that. And then after working on that for a year or so, I ended up with my, you know, being partners in another company called Millennium, where we published Doc Savage, The Man of Bronze, and The Wild Wild West, H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu, Anne Rice's The Mummy, and various other things. And as I'm recalling correctly, I think it was in 1991, summer of 91, fall of 91, I'm not sure, Mike Gustavich did call me up and said that his license on the book, the Innovations license on the book, was about to expire, and he was willing to sell it, the rights. He just didn't want to go through the whole licensing thing, and would we be interested? And so I said, sure, you know. So we bought the rights of the Justice Machine from Mike, and then later when me and my other partner, who was my wife, Melissa, when we left Millennium, we took a number of the properties with us, and that was one of them, the Justice Machine. And I've owned the Justice Machine since 1991, and it's been sort of lying, you know, unpublished and fallow since 1992 until recently.
Cool. So how did you, let's talk a little bit about how you hooked up with Moonstone then to bring the title back now.
Well, I had been a novelist for many years. I mean, after the whole comics crash of 1993, I just ended up going in another direction, and I created a science fiction novel series called Outlanders under the pen name of James Axler, and I wrote that for many years. And I really didn't have much interest in doing anything with comics, you know, particularly. And with the comics properties that we owned. So we were, my wife and I, Melissa, were at a writer's conference in Connecticut. I think this was in late 2006. We were guest speakers. And a company called Adams Media, who's owned by the mother company who owns this comic buyer's guide and things like that, they approached us to write a book about how to write graphic novels. And they have a whole series called the Everything Guidebook series, you know, which is sort of like your Idiot's Guide. This is the Everything to Writing Graphic Novels. So we wrote that, and some of the artwork that we used in it was from the Justice Machine, the Millennium Justice Machine, that is, and a couple of pages from the Innovation Justice Machine, just, you know, for illustrative purposes, examples and such. And after that, I was getting, you know, contacts, people saying, "Oh, Justice Machine, I remember them, I love them, why haven't they been published again, you know, why not?" So then the fellow, I think his name is Nick Barucci, called me up, Dynamite Entertainment, I think that's who it is, yeah, he called me up one day and expressed an interest in either licensing or buying the Justice Machine from me, and I wasn't too interested in selling it, so we discussed doing a licensing thing. But he told me that the company, if they licensed it, would have creative control and he would want to do a complete reboot, and I didn't really want to do that. You know, I didn't want to lose the creative control, nor did I want to just do, you know, I just didn't see the point in a reboot. You know, I mean, what could you do? I mean, the series had already been rebooted a couple of times and I just didn't feel like doing it. And so that was about it, but then I thought, well, let's test the water. So Melissa and I put together a graphic novel, a trade paperback compilation of several of the issues that I had written for Innovation when that Daryl and I had worked on. And so we released that, you know, this was in 2009, so we released that through, you know, comic shops and such, and got a really good response. It sold, you know, pretty well. Got a good review in the Comic Buyer's Guide for it, and so I was thinking, well, maybe it is time to, you know, do something with the Justice Machine again. Now, but I had not really moved on it because I was still, you know, busy doing other things with, you know, novels and such. Then I was talking to Joe Gentile one day last summer, not quite a year ago. I had written a short story for a Green Hornet anthology, which he was putting together at the time. And we were just discussing, I don't even know how it came up, I think, but he said something along the lines of he would like to do a superhero book if he could find the rights to it, like the Justice Machine. And I said, well, I own the Justice Machine, dude. And he's like, what? I said, yeah, we've been talking now for a couple of months. You didn't. He said, I've been hunting for the rights to that for a long time. I said, well, I got them.
Talking to the right guy. That's always good. It's like, I'd like something like X. And it's like, well, I can do X for you.
Well, yeah, apparently, you know, he'd been looking for the rights to it. He'd been wanting to do more of a superhero, super team kind of a thing, but he wanted something that already pre-existed, and already had something of a built-in readership and cachet, and of course the Justice Machine fit the bill. So that's basically how that came about. Fortunately, he let me have the creative control instead of wresting it away. So that's how that came about.
Very good. Now, you're doing the art with David Enebral. Why don't you talk a little bit about the relationship you have with David and how you go about the creative process of going from idea to finished comic?
Well, a long time ago, back in the Cambrian age of comics, back in the 80s, can I go just give a little bit of a bio of myself
as far as
me writing? Okay.
Absolutely.
There was a company called Adventure Publications, and they published a lot of different things called Adventurers, Warriors.
I remember those comics. I got those comics.
All right.
Didn't some of those have, like, Peter Sue, HSU?
Peter Sue, yeah, he did Elf Warrior and stuff like that, and they had Ninja Elite and things. Over a period of time, I ended up writing four of their five titles, you know, the Star Rangers, which I worked with Jim Mooney on, and Death Hawk, which was Adam Hughes' first work, okay. So anyway, when I was working with Adam on the first issue of Death Hawk, even though we'd worked together on a couple of Death Hawk short stories, you know, I loved his layouts very much. I loved the way he laid out a page and how his composition, just, I loved it, right? So then he left Death Hawk after the first issue to go work on the Maze Agency for Kimiko, and I understood, you know, but it left me kind of in a quandary. And even though his replacement artist, Rick Levins, who eventually ended up, I guess, being one of the most prolific artists on Captain America, he came in, but I still wanted the layout and the look that Adam had established, right? I didn't want just a usual five or six panel per page grid. So I thought, well, the best way to do it is to just do the layouts myself, and if the artist doesn't like them or has a better idea, at least I've given him a suggestion of the direction I want to go in, right? Mm-hmm. So I did that with the first issue of Death Hawk that Rick Levins and I worked on, and then afterwards I said, you still want me to do it? He goes, oh, hell yeah, saves me a lot of time. I don't have to break my brain trying to, you know, figure out how to put this together. And I thought, yeah, and I hate writing full script. You know, so that's how it started. So I ended up working that way from just about then on, just doing the thumbnails, panel breakdowns for the artist. So every artist I've ever worked with likes that method better than full script. I always say you don't have to follow what I do. I mean, this is just a suggestion, but it gives me a better idea for negative space where the balloons and captions and things like that should go, and display lettering like sound effects. So anyway, that's how I work with David on Justice Machine, and I asked him if he wanted to work that way, and he'd never done it before like that. And then when I sent him the stuff, now we're into the third issue, and he's like, nah, I could never go back to full script.
Now, when I see the cover on the, I was looking at your website, justicemachine.com, and it's got some nice cover images up there. Now, it looks like there was maybe a little bit of redesign on some of the costumes and stuff.
Well, actually, there's been major redesign on them.
I would say they don't look like I remember them looking, but you know, I can still tell who the characters are. Why don't you talk a little bit about the process that you guys went through on doing the redesigns?
Well, the costumes had actually been redesigned back when Daryl Banks and I worked on the book together at Innovation back in 1989, and then he redesigned them even further when we were working together on the Justice Machine when it was at Millennium. We did two issues at Millennium. But we were still going with the way that all the characters had individual costumes, okay? So, if Daryl hears this, he probably won't want me to repeat this, but it's funny. Anyway, when he was doing those character redesigns, the costumes, and they were beautiful, don't get me wrong, you can see them on JusticeMachine.com. They're really elaborate, but then when you sit down and have to draw them panel after panel, you go crazy, right? It's like, oh my God, I forgot this spike on Demon's shoulder, and I forgot this part on Challenger's boot. That sort of thing. So I decided when we got the green light to do this, I didn't want to do the individual costumes, partly because it's just too much of a brain breaker for the artist, okay? So I said, let's standardize them, make it more of a uniform, more like, you know, the Green Lantern Corps, or for that matter, even the X-Men type of outfits that they wore in the movies, you know. But we'll differentiate them by color. So we went back to the original color schemes for the costumes, which was, you know, green for Diviner and the shades of brown and tan for Challenger and so forth and so on. Now, the actual design of the costumes, redesign of the costumes, was done by a very talented artist named Preston Azevedo. He redesigned them. We went and did the back and forth thing on them. And the color schemes were done by Deirdre DeLay, who was a colorist for Millennium back in the day, and who just happens to be my daughter. So we get everybody
that
involved.
Helps. A little bit of an inside track.
Yes. So also, I came up with a unifying symbol. I wanted to brand them more so than before, an insignia. So Daryl had actually come up with a form of this back when we were doing it for Millennium back in the early 90s, which was like a Scales of Justice inside a machine gear wheel, right? Mm-hmm. He had it on a couple of the costumes. So with this one, my wife Melissa, who is a professional graphic designer, I mean, that's how she makes a living. So it's not all complete nepotism. She took that basic idea and refined it. So now they wear these, like, Scales of Justice inside gear wheels on their costumes, like badges, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they're functional. When you touch them, they do something with the costumes, you know. Do various things like cause, like make them invulnerable or that sort of thing. Stealth mode, things of that nature. So we've souped them up somewhat.
Very cool. Let's do this now. I'm gonna go the direction of, I don't want spoilers, but let's talk a little bit about the situation and the challenges that are facing the team in this new series. So what, now we've talked about who these guys are, where they came from, and all that, what are we going to be seeing when we pick up Justice Machine number 1 from Moonstone?
Well, you're going to see that they have been gone for 18 years. They've just gone. Not just in comic book years, but real time as well. And they're suddenly back. Boom. So I've taken the attitude like, well, what if the Fantastic Four just disappeared? You know, not just 18 years comic book years, but 18 real-time years, too, and now all of a sudden they're back, you know. So as far as the Justice Machine knows, they've only been gone seconds. So when they show back up, they find a world that's almost, you know, it's in terrible crisis, which relates directly to their backstory on the planet of Jor-El. And this turns into why I explain how this planet, how a planet supposedly in an alternate reality had the Earth name of Jor-El, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually explain where this planet came from, how it came about, how they ended up on Earth, and everything else. And it's a full circle miniseries. It's basically, they deal with backstory stuff, but in a way that it's not going to confuse the reader, but also is going to be the biggest issue of their life, okay? Biggest deal that they've ever faced. You know, this is like reality itself. You know, the world is just, you know, it's basically, they find out that when they came from Jor-El all those years ago to Earth, they actually set into motion all the events which made Jor-El actually come about. And when they were gone for 18 years, that was able to, you know, when they came on Earth, they sort of were able to stop it somewhat. But when they left, when they were gone for 18 years, you know, that whole process accelerated. So now when they're back, it's like two realities are warring for domination. You know, are we going to have like a 1984 kind of a world, which is like encroaching on this one, quantum entanglement, as I call it? Or is it going to be the world that we know now, you know? And they just reappear in the middle of this.
Sounds very cool.
And they don't know what to do. I mean, they don't know which steps to take. If they turn right, are they going to strengthen the Jor-Elian influence? If they turn left, will they weaken it? If they stay mid-range, will nothing happen? And so they find, you know, a lot of things have changed. But, you know, it's like, it ties in. See, we're going to have a one-shot special, which will be out, hopefully, I don't know, in October. Which will fill in the gaps between the last issue of the Millennium version of the Justice Machine and the first issue of the Moonstone Justice Machine. So, you know, it's not going to be totally, you know, confusing. People who right. might be slightly confused by what's going on here, but you'll still be able to pick it up. I mean, the good thing is, you know, none of the Justice Machine had secret identities or anything, so it's not like they have newspaper reporter jobs to get back to after 18 years or anything.
Right. I mean, they just were the members of the Justice Machine. So
that was it. I had
kind of like the FF, right?
Exactly. So by the time the miniseries is over, everything, all the different incarnations of the Justice Machine, like the ones that appeared from Noble Comics and the Kimiko version, they're similar, but there's differences. It's the Kimiko was sort of a reboot. I'm going to blend them all, and it's all going to be one cohesive reality by the end of the miniseries. So, then you go on from there.
Very good. Well, you've got your work cut out for you, and
yeah.
What I like about this is that it's something that's just as you're, you know, planning it to be just as accessible for fans of the old stuff, which I don't know how many of us are still, you know, kicking around.
Well, apparently
but also,
a lot.
Yeah, you know, and that's great. We should all be reading it and then bringing along the new people who haven't read the old stuff before.
Well, the good thing is to me that, or one of the strong points is about it, is that the Justice Machine has a cachet. It has a history. It has a backstory. I mean, granted, it doesn't go back as far as, say, the Fantastic Four or the X-Men, but it does have one. So it's not like somebody has just cooked up yet another new super team, you know, and just thrown it out there. You know, this is like, these people have, these characters, they've been around. So, and they're legitimate, so it's not like, you know, somebody just coming up with, you know, Captain Avenger or something and saying that he's been around for a long time. They really have been around for a long time, 30 years this year.
Yeah, we call that character Sentry.
Yeah. So we're going to, you know, the new readers will find it accessible, and hopefully they'll find it interesting because, you know, these are characters that don't, their backstory is pretty unique. You know, they're not mutants or anything like that. They're basically soldiers, you know. And the tone I took with this book, with the miniseries, is that it's tough and it's mature. But when I say mature, I don't mean it in the debase sense of, you know, a lot of cheesecake or, you know, just using the chance to have a superhero use four-letter words or anything, or show a lot of blood. I mean, in the sense that what these people are facing, this is tough stuff, you know. And the characters are dealing with it in a mature fashion, in the sense that they're not freaking out or anything of that nature. They're upset, they're angry, but they're not. There's not a lot of histrionics or anything in it.
Right.
And they know when they realize what's at stake, they have to go and do it. But I'm also, what's fun too is I'm introducing some of the supporting cast from the old days, like the Free Force, which were, you know, Night Owl and Havoc and a Miss Liberty. They show back up. And also their two most, the Justice Machine's worst enemies, their two most implacable enemies, Zarin and Dark Force. You may remember Zarin from the old Kimiko days. He was the guy with the goatee and the eye patch.
Okay, yeah. I didn't remember the name, but...
Yeah. He doesn't have the eye patch or the goatee anymore, but he's still just as nasty. So, yeah, it's a big epic story. I mean, I'm very happy with it. Working with David Innebral has been a pleasure, been a joy. He's really... He's young. I mean, this is some of his, really... big thing. I mean, he's done some work for DC, like Batman and Superman, and believe a couple other things. But he's really, really dedicated to this, which has been nice.
Great.
And I'm very happy too with the cover by Jeff Slimmons. He's a great artist. So hopefully. You know, the retailers will order the book in sufficient quantities.
Well, the thing that's going to help the retailers order the books in sufficient quantities is if people listening to this think this sounds interesting, and I can attest, you know, the old Justice Machine series was cool. I really enjoyed it. And when I saw the reboot here, or the relaunch, not reboot, I was excited because I saw that name that I recognized. The way that we're going to get it in the shops is... go to your retailer now, because they're making their order forms for June. Tell them on page 296 in the Moonstone section, you want them to get a copy of Justice Machine number 1 for you. You know, hopefully if enough people ask them to get a copy of Justice Machine number 1, they'll buy it for you guys, and then they'll also maybe get a couple copies for the rack as well, and some other people can see this book. But this is not a book that we want to just... leave to the devices of the comic shop owners to order without us helping them along. Our interest.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do too with a lot of various press releases and things. And the funny thing is, I was looking at or found out some of the sales figure on the Justice Machine when it was with Kimiko was always averaged around 70,000 per issue. So, I mean, there are Marvel and DC titles that would kill to get half those numbers now.
Yeah, no kidding. That would put it close to the top 10 nowadays with those kind of numbers.
I know. So I would like, obviously, I don't think that's going to quite happen, but it would be nice that if people supported the book, and I can tell you, I don't think they will be disappointed if they do support it, because... It's quirky. It's fun too. I've tried to make it fun. It's sort of dark, but not dark enough to where it's all like, you know, you feel depressed after you read it. And there's enough stuff in there that the veteran readers will get a real charge out of some of the stuff that goes on. You know, like my reimagining of Talisman, for example. I'll go ahead and just tell you, as I said about Talisman, his powers were tied in with, you know, karma. He had to do good in order for something good to happen to him. So this, at some point in the past, he got so tired of bad things happening to him, he just became a priest.
Oh, there you go. Well, that'll kind of do it for you.
So
do good stuff.
Well, he's hoping that'll work. That's the thing. He's not quite sure yet. I don't believe there's a, you know, character quite like that in any super team now, especially like, you know, this guy's costume sort of reflects it a little bit. But it's a lot of fun. The book is. I can just tell your readers right now. They will not be not your readers. Your listeners. If they pick it up and they'll read it, they'll be happy with it.
Very good. Well, thank you for taking the time with me. And just again a reminder: go out to your comic shops and also take a look at JusticeMachine.com. You can check out some covers, you can check out character profiles, and there's a lot more information about the team and the book, both its history and the relaunch, out there at JusticeMachine.com.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.